when I was a teenager, I would dream that I had killed somebody and I had to hide the body. And then I would wake up feeling that I had actually killed someone. I'm feeling very remorseful and, oh my God, what did I do? And then just realizing, oh, it was just a dream. But I had that dream several times. And then eventually I realized that that dream was my guilt for being gay.
What's good? I'm Nikisha Elise Williams, and this is Black and Published, bringing you the journeys of writers, poets, playwrights, and storytellers of all kinds. Today's guest is Carlos Allende, author of the novel Coffee Shopping Murder Love, which won the Quill Prose Award. In the novel, the cast of characters are all rude, offensive, and, you know, only casually racist. Interactions and experiences Carlos ripped right out of his own life.
Somebody I was working for, a client, asked me my opinion and about a Mexican worker. And he said, well, I don't know if I should let him go and hire a white guy instead. And I was like, hey, that's a little bit racist. And he said, oh, I didn't mean it in a racist way. What I meant was smart, but I said white. And I was like, what?
Born and raised in Mexico City, Carlos has a master's degree and PhD in psychology. He moved to the States in 2009 and now lives with his husband in their own little bubble in Santa Monica. But that doesn't mean he isn't aware of the issues in the world. Carlos opens up about how he captures the essence of those controversies by creating horrible characters. What kept him going after receiving 100 plus rejections? And the two biggest regrets of his writing career. Carlos shares his story when Black and Published continues. All right, so my first question is, when did you know that you were a writer?
All right, I guess I always knew in a way, and I was just remembering about a little episode from my childhood. I had this friend that I used to play dominoes with. We were like 10 or 11, and then we would use the dominoes pieces as if they were Lego pieces to build houses. But we would play domino first to know. He had a huge set, and the one who won got most of the pieces. And he won that time, and he started building his house, and he was calling it the mansion, and he was pretending that it was the Jackson's 5 mansion and super rich and stuff. And I think I had only like 3 pieces. But then I started making a story with my little pieces. And my family was very poor and very destitute, and they didn't have anything. And it was a funny story. And I don't know, after a few minutes, he would stop playing and just listen. He would just listen to my story. And I kept going and going and going for, I don't know, maybe 20 minutes pretending this. And that's when I realized that I could charm people and enchant them and keep them engaged.
So knowing this at 10 or 12 playing dominoes, how does that carry you through your life? Like, did you always just then want to tell stories and try to like make a career of it?
Yes, but I guess I was too afraid of it because I knew that writers don't always, well, hardly ever make any money. So I didn't study literature or Spanish because I grew up in Mexico. And my background is in economics. And then I have a master's in management. Eventually, I studied psychology. But I was always trying to get a secure day job, secure money, and try to write on my free time. And I was too afraid. I think it would have been better for me if I took the risk. I know a lot of people that went to college, they studied English or literature, and they have had good paying jobs. And I guess if you study what is your true passion, you would always find a way to make money. And I didn't study what was my true passion. I'm like trying to get away from finance still.
But you still found a way to write, because your first novel in Spanish, Cuadrillas Encontranzas, was self-published, correct?
Yes. And it was a mistake, and I didn't know much about the publishing industry. What I did is I finished it, I didn't even try to edit it. I didn't know you had to edit. And I submitted it to some publishers. And of course, it was rejected. And I was very disappointed. But I just tried like 3 or 4. And after that few rejections, I was like, oh, okay, didn't get anywhere. And I kept editing a little bit. And much later, years later, I found a place that was called a hybrid place, that they would help me edit the novel and publish it, but I would be responsible for distribution. So I worked with them for about 3-4 months. We edited it together, and I had edited it before and changed a lot of stuff by myself. And eventually we got to a good place, and I had already signed a contract, and then I was looking for ways to distribute it. And I contacted Planeta, which is the biggest publisher in Spanish, and they told me they wanted the novel, and that they would send me a contract. But then I told them that I was going to self-publish it, and then the financial crisis started, and I never got the contract, and it just fell away. And then I moved to the States, so I didn't sell many copies. I sold copies to friends and family and here and there. And I must have sold like 500 maybe, like hustling. Then I realized that self-publishing back then, at least, or without knowing much about the publishing industry, was a big mistake. Mm. And I should have kept trying and trying and trying and pushing. And that's what I did with my second and my third novels.
So then let's talk about your second and then obviously your third novel, because that's what we're going to focus on for today's interview. Publishing is often considered a very mystical, opaque kind of industry. Not many people know how to get into it. Even when you know how to get into it, you still don't know how to get into it. And then you had coming to the States, and maybe not so much a language barrier, but just a culture barrier in getting into the industry here. So how did you eventually break into publishing to get your second and third novels out into the world?
Well, I had a language barrier a little bit, but I didn't want to acknowledge it. I thought my English was perfect. And when I gave friends a draft of my first novel to, when I was just starting to, my second novel, sorry, my first one in English, I would ask friends to read it and give me their opinion. They would tell me like, well, it's full of grammatical mistakes, but some of them are cute. And I was really offended. But and I would just kept trying. And I found an editor that I paid myself for the first one, and actually two editors. I worked with one first and then with another one because I wanted their opinion. I realized with my first novel the how useful it was to have an editor. And it took me about 5 years. And then I just kept trying and trying and trying and trying and getting rejection after rejection after rejection. And of course, it makes you depressed and angry and disappointed, but you just have to keep trying. And one thing that I started doing is change your letter, change your work. If they reject your first few pages, well, maybe those first few pages are not the best. Keep working on your novel. Every rejection, maybe you got the bad reader. Maybe your work wasn't perfect. So just keep improving it. It took me, I don't remember how long to get, but probably a year until eventually I found Rare Bird Books and I got out the first novel in English. My first novel was a historical melodrama. I did a lot of research. I read a lot of books. I really, really did my research. And I was very careful with the language. I worked a lot. And with the second one, I did also a lot of research. It's Love or the Witches of Windward Circle is set throughout the first half of the 20th century in Venice, California. So I did research about the Californios, the Hispanic people that lived here before the Anglos came. They lived in poverty. They weren't that famous. And there was a lot of racism back then. I love the 1950s, but we tend to idealize that time. And it was way far from perfect. So I wanted to portray that in my book as well. But then finally, with Coffee Shopping Modern Love, I was tired of doing research. I was tired of working too hard. And I said, I'm just gonna crank it. And I was attending this writing group called Writer's Block in Santa Monica. We met in a church called Church of the Nazarene. I really miss those days. It was wonderful. You would just go there. There was nothing else to do but write. There were a lot of people there. You would write for 2 hours and then talk about what you wrote or talk about whatever. And I wrote my first draft there. It took me maybe a year and a half. And then, of course, I would edit it at home. But most of it, I wrote it there. And because I decided to crank it, I would just write the scenes that I would like to see in my book and not worry about that. I call them stitch them together until later. Mm-hmm. And then I realized, okay, the stitching is actually pretty easy. You don't need to tell much about what happens in between. And at the same time, I was doing a master's in media psychology that then became a PhD in media psychology. And we study how media affects behavior. And what I wanted to find out is how to make my writing more compelling, more engaging. So I applied to that. That was the focus of my research, and I applied that into my book. So I designed my book to be as engaging as possible. And again, once I finished it, I started sending it everywhere. I kept getting rejected and rejected and rejected. I collected the rejections. I have 94 rejection emails and a lot more that never answered. And I think this is important to mention. My doctoral dissertation was on the motivational effect of compassion on secure and engagement. So what I proposed is a solution to the sadness paradox. Like, why do we enjoy sad stories? And I argued that, yes, sad stories make you sad, but they also make you feel compassion. And it's compassion what makes you engage. And when you're reading a story, you cannot help the characters, but you can stay with them throughout their journey and you can find out what they want. So I said, okay, I'm writing about horrible people and maybe that's why people don't are rejecting my book. So I wrote a prologue, and in the prologue, I made the situation of one of the characters very distressful, and he was in danger and he was about to die, and but at the same time funny. I added that prologue and I submitted it again to a contest and I won. Mm-hmm. So, and that's how I got with Red Hand Press.
So let's talk about the submission to the contest after the prologue, because in the prologue, there is compassion that you evoke from the reader. Like, oh, you kind of feel bad for him. It's still funny and it's still like, wait, what's happening here? And it's not quite clear. But there are two lines in the prologue, and I know I'm jumping ahead, but where he says something like, self-pity is addictive, and the more you feel sorry for yourself, the better it feels. There's beauty in sadness. And so I was like, it was kind of like a very striking kind of moment, but then also very observational and critical and acute of, you know, how we operate as humans. And so why do you think that prologue led to your submission winning the Quill Prose Award?
It led for readers to be engaged and interested and wanting to know more and giving a chance to the book. I think it is because when you feel compassion for someone, you want to help. You have an altruistic response. And that's something that is not unique to humans. It's we share it with all social animals. And when you feel compassion, what it does, it's not exactly clear what happens inside your brain, but you release oxytocin and you release dopamine. When you feel compassion or when you feel love for someone, the oxytocin reduces that stress and makes you want to be closer. And we crave that feeling.
So with that said, and evoking that compassion for your reader and then winning the award, how did you feel winning the award and then winning publication with Red Hen Press once you made that change to your novel?
It was very exciting. It was something that I was waiting for a long time. I love them. I mean, Red Hand Press, they have been so wonderful. Like, it has been such a beautiful experience with them. So helpful, so approachable. And it's lovely that they chose to make my book hardback. So I felt pretty good. I was singing when I knew. Yeah, I remember when I called that call and I made a little song and I was singing it when my husband came back and I told him and we were singing together. It was a lot of fun.
All right. So let's get to the book, Coffee Shopping Murder Love. If you could read something from it and then we'll talk about the book and these people that you've created.
All right. Well, I got to say first a little warning. These are people that are funny. Funny enough that you want to join them in the ride, but they're also horrible people. Yes. And that was part of it. That was part of my challenge. I wanted to make the reader empathize for horrible people and root for them, but at the same time, never forget that they're horrible people.
Yeah, I got you. All right, Black and Published family, it's time for the reading. So who are the horrible people in Carlos Allende's novel, Coffee Shopping Murder Love? Well, it follows two gay men, Charlie and Jignesh, from their first date to becoming frenemies to casual lovers to actual friends in the midst of an accidental murder spree. And if that weren't enough, the two finesse themselves into an interior design gig for a multimillionaire that takes them to Mexico with the dead bodies as more corpses keep piling up. Here's Carlos.
So this is a part, I cannot make a Southern accent, but this is supposed to be with a Southern accent and with a horrible voice. I'm going to try, but I'm going to fail, but I'm going to still try it. This is Charlie talking. Friday, I closed yet another week without having a single sale, and Tunisia had to let me go. I did like Julianne Moore in Safe and started sobbing quietly. Poor Tunisia. She's an excellent boss and an awfully inspiring person, but she doesn't know what to do when white people start crying. She got all mortified like that one time with that irresponsible med addict. What's her face? Some trashy suburban name like Kimberly or Peggy. Started crying too because Tunisia wouldn't approve an advance on her commissions. Kimberly had terrible skin, but her hair color was just gorgeous. And it was her natural color, I imagine. You wouldn't think that a drug addict driving a 1987 Crown Victoria full of 10 years of fast food wrappers would spend her hard-earned commissions on hair coloring, would you? Not when her teeth and skin were what needed attention. Anyway, Tunisia is such a great supervisor. She's always super considerate. She has a bright future ahead within the company. The last thing I wanted to do was to make her feel uncomfortable. After a minute, I brushed away my tears, took a deep breath, and said, "Thank you for everything, Tunisia," and that I would just go empty my desk and leave. When I reached the door, all the repressed emotions came out at once, however. I thought he was a man I would spend the rest of my life with. I think I bawled at one point. But he kills people. Thank God that Tunisia couldn't understand what I was saying. She called Cherise to bring me a glass of water. When I calmed down, I promised Tunisia I would do better if she just gave me another chance. I even knelt down and attempted to kiss her feet.
So this book, I didn't know what to expect. A lot of times, you know, authors and writers, we talk about, you know, it's very voicey. It's voicey. It has lots of voice. And sometimes it could be like, what are you talking about? When I read this book, I was like, this has all the voice. Like, I immediately knew what that meant. It was brash. It was rude. It was offensive. It was racist. It was all of these things. And I was like, one, how did you come up with this story?
I like tragic characters. Let me begin there. So growing up, we always had books in my house, but we didn't have children books.
Mm.
So the first book I ever read, the full book, it was Anne Frank's diary, I was seven. And my sister was reading it in high school or middle school. And my mother had a lot of romantic novels from Philippa Carr. And then I read the classics. I never read children books. So I always had a flair for drama. Mm-hmm. I thought that life had to be miserable to be interesting and important and all that. And I didn't understand Anne Frank when I read it, but later I have reread it again, and it's a very good book, and it's actually a very positive book because she was a very positive person. Anyhow, one of my favorite writers is Balzac, and he writes about horrible people too.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that I wouldn't call it a problem, but a tendency that could be problematic in pop culture and literature is the superabundance of heroes, or our preference for nice, beautiful, perfect people in stories, especially in American pop culture. And I feel that when you always identify with the good people, you come to think of yourself as good. And we're all inherently good, but I don't believe in the world as good and bad. I believe on selfish and not too selfish people, or generous people. I think it's like a spectrum. And I don't think that people are inherently evil, just selfish and conceited perhaps and stuff. And I think that when you always identify with the heroes, with the good characters, you come to think of yourself as a honest person. So when you do something wrong, you think, oh, it's okay, it's for me, I'm a good person. And when you see superhero movies, the superheroes destroy the city and cause a lot of damage and all this, and that makes you think, like, if you're always convinced that you're always a nice person, and so you may come to think that the end justifies the means, and you always think that. But if you can see yourself as a bad person sometimes, you can reflect on what you do and what you're doing wrong, and then change your behavior. So that is one of the things that I wanted to achieve with this book. I wanted people to empathize with horrible people, see what they're doing, and realize that it is wrong, and maybe reflect on their own behavior. And now, what inspired this book? I used to have this dream when I was a teenager. It was a recurring dream. I would dream that I had killed somebody. I wouldn't see how I killed that person. I was just with the body. And I had to hide the body because I was in the kitchen and my mom was in the living room watching TV. And I would have to get rid of the body somehow. And then I would wake up feeling that I had actually killed someone. I'm feeling very remorseful and, oh my God, what did I do? And then just realizing, oh, it was just a dream. But I had that dream several times. And then eventually I realized that that dream was my guilt for being gay, that I felt guilty because I was gay and was trying to hide my homosexuality. And the corpse was like a metaphor in my dream for being gay and stuff. And eventually I grew that, and that dream stopped coming. I came out of the closet, blah, blah, blah. I'm happy. I'm married. My mom loves my husband. But it was such an intense, horrible feeling when I would wake up that I wanted to share that. And I wanted to make people feel what it feels to feel ashamed and guilty of what you are.
Mm.
So that's one of the feelings that I wanted to provoke with this book. And there's a body, and people are trying to hide the body and get rid of it. And then I just collected the stuff that I would hear from other people. I was too lazy, and I based most of my characters in people I know, really nice people, most of them. And so I would just steal a little bit of their personality and dress them up with my maliciousness and my malice. And And then just trying to make it funny. At the beginning, I wanted to change my characters. I thought I had to. And then I realized, no, like real people don't change. So they got to remain as they are. Like there's going to be some change. But the change doesn't always have to be on the characters. The change is many times is on the reader.
With the parts of the story that are casually racist, were those your way of commenting on today's climate? Like you have, I think one of my favorite ones was early in the book, Jignesh says, "What God am I supposed to pray to in these situations? Lord Krishna, help me, and I swear never pray again by the name of a Christian God." And I just like, I cackled at that line. I was just like, and there's others like white, tall, straight male. That's enough to guarantee anyone a decent life on this planet. Like these observations that are offensive, that are like the inner thoughts of people and, you know, casually racist sometimes. Was that your way to comment on everything that's happening in the world from your point of view?
Yes, I mean, definitely. And many of these comments I have heard. Mm. And one that I heard once that I was like, what? Somebody I was working for, a client, asked me about, asked me my opinion and about a Mexican worker. And he said, well, I don't know if I should let him go and hire a white guy instead. And I was like, hey, that's a little bit racist. And he said, oh, I didn't mean it in a racist way. What I meant was smart, but I said white. And I was like, what? So I said, well, this has to go in my book. And
it sure did.
And I haven't been the victim of much racism or almost nothing at all here in the States, but I live in a bubble. I live in Santa Monica. I'm married to a white guy. I inherited many of his friends. But I realize what's happening in the world. Sometimes I joke and say that Twitter woke me, or because I see what people go through, and I was like, oh my God, I live in such a small bubble, but I'm aware of it. And then that's part of what I studied in my class. And we are still very, very, very extremely segregated in this country. Mm. You don't have meaningful interactions with people from other ethnicities or other races. Even here in LA, there are so many languages, and you're aware of the Armenians or the Persians and stuff, but you don't know many of them. There's a place called Koreatown here. A lot of Koreans live there. And yes, I know a lot of Koreans, but we're not really that in touch with each other. So we still have a way to go. And we have all these weird, wrong misconceptions about race. And but I wanted to address them, and I didn't want to scold people or preach to people. I just wanted to put them there so people realize the things they say, the things they think, and so they would see it and reflect on that without being preachy.
Mm. Yeah, I definitely saw that, because I was like. Like the first few times I laughed, and I was like, this is not really funny, but this is very accurate. And so then I was like, there has to be a point here. I think one of my favorite at the end, well, not in the end, toward the middle, it's Charlie says, the government should send me a monthly stipend to compensate me for all of my suffering. Where if once people get to know Charlie, it's like, you're the cause of all of your suffering. Was that kind of your reflection of, in part, your bubble, and how those who have the most privilege portray themselves as being the most victimized?
Yes. And we many times we don't realize of our own privilege, and we feel victimized. And yeah, that's something that Charlie's definitely not taking advantage of his privilege in the way he should, or he is in a way. But he doesn't realize he's taking advantage of that privilege and says all this. He says pretty much that he thinking of all these Black and Latinx people that get checks from the, and that's things that people say, and you're like, what are you talking about? And people love to say that, oh, if you're poor, it's because you want to, because you don't work enough and stuff. And they don't realize like poverty is, it traps you. It's a trap, and it's hard to escape that. And it's easy to say all those horrible comments without realizing where you are. And that, yes, that's why I wanted to point it out. It's funny, but at the same time, I wanted to make people realize that they're wrong when they think that.
And talking about poverty, it makes me think about how many references there are to money in this book, in direct and indirect ways, and materialism and consumerism. And as I was looking at the book cover, it's like Pandora's box, and then the words come out: coffee, shopping, murder, love. But then I feel like the one that's missing is money, especially with the way that it ends. What role does money and finance, especially with your background, play for you in this book and in your own life?
I guess we love to say that money doesn't bring happiness, but in a way it does. It helps a lot. People with wealthy people don't have to worry about a lot of stuff. It gives you education, it gives you comfort, it makes you healthy. It allows you to eat better, to work out, to travel, to educate yourself. So money is a good advantage. And we have a society that is very unequal. And at the same time, we're obsessed with money. So I guess money has always been a concern in my life. I was too afraid to study literature, and I wanted to make some money. And I'm always a little bit worried, especially, we're living in a rat race. You want to put money for retirement. You want to be able to do that, especially when you live in New York, I live in LA, how expensive things are, how much we pay on rent, etc. So we're always, money is constantly in your head, and as a way to improve your life. And then also there are many, I have met people that are so greedy, and that they already have money and they want more and more and more. And I think that's something that could happen to all of us. But the solution to that is simple. The more compassion you can feel for others, the more you know their story, the more willing you will be to live in a more equal world. So yeah, money is a big concern. Getting money, being rich, going up in society, because that's one of our main motivations. We want to climb up in the social hierarchy, and money is one way to do that. So I'm not saying that we should do horrible things for money. I'm just saying that it plays an important role in our lives. So, I wanted to mention it in my book.
No problem. Your previous book before this one was a horror type of novel. And then you are from Mexico, where telenovelas are very popular. And yes, this book, at one point I was like, am I reading horror? Did I get tricked into reading something scary? But then it's also very dramatic and very over the top. Were you trying to combine those two genres in this novel with the drama of the telenovela and kind of the dark undertones of like a horror story?
Horror, probably not, or at least not consciously. Drama, yes. Yes, I think that's what calls attention to us. We are wired to pay more attention to negative events. So I always tell, I teach a class on storytelling, and I tell my students, you should always focus on negative events, because that's what makes people engage with your story. So, telenovelas are so over the top and dramatic and campy sometimes. And that's what I wanted to get. So I wanted to make people uncomfortable.
Yes.
But not scared. And I think that's part of what engages us with the story. If we don't make people uncomfortable, but at the same time tell them you're only gonna resolve that discomfort by continuing with the story, then they're not gonna engage. You have to find the narrow area where not too much discomfort, but at least some discomfort. And I love horrible people. I think that's part of the reason why is because as a gay man growing up, you always saw the villain being a little bit gay, especially on Disney movies. And I mean, Ursula from The Little Mermaid is based on Divine, inspired by Divine. And you see the, what is the name? Prince John from Robin Hood and all these very campy, very gay villains from, I mean, Scar from The Lion King and stuff. They're very gay. And then because I grew up in the 20th century, and I mean, things have changed a lot. So you used to feel like you were the bad guy, the villain and stuff. So you identified with these people and then you wanted to tell their story. You wanted to tell the part of the bad guy, explain why are they bad and stuff.
Yeah. All right. So I want to move to a speed round and a little game before I let you go for your morning. So what is your favorite book?
I would say two of Balzac would be Cousin Bet and Cousin Ponce. Mm-hmm. They're also about horrible people. But Balzac is dead. Alive writers, Elena Ferrante, definitely. My Brilliant Friend, the four Neapolitan novels. I strongly recommend them. I'm obsessed with them. And also Susan Jane Gilman. She is so positive, so funny, so lovable. I feel as if she was... as if she were my best friend.
So there are a lot of pop culture references in this novel. What is your favorite movie?
Howard's End from the 80s. I just love that movie.
Who is your favorite artist?
Max Richter, Philip Glass. I love modern composers.
What do you think is the best book to movie or TV adaptation?
I would say the most faithful and good, My Brilliant Friend. They made a series in HBO. But then movies that were better and improved over the original book, I would say Blade Runner and also Atonement. The book is very good as well, but the movie is just fantastic.
Because Blade Runner is based on Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, right?
Yeah.
I read that in undergrad. What is the biggest difference between Mexico and the United States?
Well, wealth to begin with. And the United States is like 10 or 15 times richer. And I would say, well, there are many differences. And you could say people here are very friendly and people in Mexico are very friendly as well. I think one thing that I like about the States is that people here are aware of their problems and try to change them, especially about race sensitivity, gender, all that stuff. And people are try to be politically correct and understand that things need to change and stuff. That is coming down to Mexico, but people are not that aware of their need to be politically correct and stuff, and they're not as woke as people are here. And I like that here. And also, I criticize that in my novel too, aesthetics. People take pride of their cities here and they keep them. I mean, Mexican people are going to hate me for this, but in America, they keep the buildings nicer, the streets cleaner and all that stuff. And it's very important. They spend money on that. And
Yeah. So then to redeem yourself, name three things you miss about Mexico.
The food. And there are a lot of good Mexican restaurants here in Los Angeles. But Mexico City restaurants are just wonderful. And then sometimes the level of connection that I have with people in Mexico City, especially like we speak the same language. I'm not talking about Spanish. It's like, I don't know. I have a very dear friend from Mexico City. We're about the same age. We grew up with the same TV shows, but we have like a very deep connection. We kind of speak the same language. You can make jokes that you cannot make with people here. It would be not because they wouldn't understand them, but because it would be too difficult to explain. So that closeness. And what else do I miss? Maybe the beaches. I lived a year in Playa del Carmen, and that was wonderful. The warm ocean, so blue, so beautiful.
Okay, so my game is called Rewriting the Classics. What's one book that you wish you would have written?
Oh, Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell, because it's a wonderful book. So beautiful, so big, so elegant. It's like reading, I don't know, Jane Austen mixed with Dickens and fantasy. And it's a wonderful book.
Name one book where you want to change the ending, and how would you do it?
I heard your other podcasts, and I heard that question before, and I was like, what book? I'm trying to think. And I guess when I don't like the ending, I tend to forget the book. So I'm not sure which one, because there are probably books that I have read that I didn't like the endings, but I forgot about them. That's a problem with a wrong ending, that if it's bad, you forget about the book.
Okay. And so then my final question for Rewriting the Classics, which you know because you've been listening, is name one book that you think is overrated or overtaught, and why?
The Pillars of the Earth, and a lot of people will hate me for this, by Ken Follett. When I remember, I saw it once as a teenager at the supermarket, I think it was like the bookstore section. And I wanted it so bad, but I didn't have enough money with me and I couldn't buy it. And then I forgot about it. And then years later, I found it and I was so excited about reading it. And I read it when I was living in Playa del Carmen. I remember reading it at the beach. And I was just like, oh my God, this book is bad. And I read the whole thing. And it was not realistic. And that's what I hated the most about it. Because, like, especially it's set in the Middle Ages. There's a character I have trouble with. She's a rich girl who loses her wealth and then ends up in poverty. But she's living in the 12th or 13th century, no education or nothing. And then she becomes rich. She learns to do business out of nowhere. She teaches herself, and then she loses her wealth, and then she chases a man through Europe, a man that rejected her. Like, oh, like who's going to do that? Like, she goes, she has a baby, and then leaves the baby to chase a man throughout Europe. She goes all the way to Santiago de Compostela, and then to Paris. Like, my God, like, you're writing a bad telenovela. So that's what ruined it for me. And it's too unrealistic. I like characters. I mean, if I'm going back again to My Brilliant Friend, they go through hell and then they make money, but it's believable. It's within, it's credible. It could happen.
You gave the best answer to this messy question I've gotten all season, and I love it. Thank you. All right. My final questions for you today is, one, what's next for you? Because after reading Coffee Shopping Murder Love, I want to know what you're working on.
I'm working on something very difficult that will require a lot of study, but I want to do it. I'm writing the story of a little gay guy who I think will be transgender. I'm working on it. But I'm not transgender, and I'm trying to understand more. And he wants to learn magic to solve his problem. So it is kind of my response to the J.K. Rowling controversy and Harry Potter. So I want to tell this story from a little gay guy that wants to become a woman. Mm. And so yeah, that's working and writing and trying to figure out how to make money out of it. That's the most difficult part.
Amen. And so my final question for you today is, once you are no longer here and you're among the ancestors, what do you want someone to write about the legacy of words and work and classes that you've left behind?
For my work, I would say I would like people to think that my books made them feel something and they made them think something. Like maybe they made them feel uncomfortable. That's all right. But they made them think and reflect a little bit about who they are and what they do and stuff. And also how other people feel. There are books that I had that I read a long time ago that I don't remember what the plot was about, but I will never, ever forget how they made me feel. So that's what I would like to achieve. Like people, oh yeah, I read your book. I don't remember anything about it except how it made me feel. And yeah, it's still here with me. That would be nice.
Thank you, Carlos.
Thank you.
Big thank you to Carlos Allende for being here today on Black and Published. Make sure you check out Carlos's latest novel, Coffee, Shopping, Murder, Love, out now from Red Hen Press. And if you're not following Carlos, follow him on the socials. He's at damned_poet on Twitter and Instagram. That's our show for the week. If you like this episode and want more Black and Published, head to our Instagram page. It's at Black and Published, and that's BLK and Published. There, I've posted a bonus clip from my interview with Carlos about how he says he cranked this novel in comparison to his first two. Make sure you check it out and let me know what you think in the comments. I'll holla at y'all next week when our guest will be Zakiya Delilah Harris, author of the novel The Other Black Girl. Until then, peace.